Good evening. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June the 14th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening is Peter Benston. Today's session is number 2001-1, and it's entitled Legacy of the Bomb. Let's listen in.
Thank you for coming out here tonight. My name is Peter Benston. I work out at the Hanford site. I've been working there almost about 10 years now. Would like to be able to tell you a little bit about myself, tell you a little bit about what I'd like to be able to share with you tonight. Primarily, I guess the first question I'd like to ask, how many people here have heard of Hanford before maybe the introduction out to me? Okay, looks like most of you have. One of the things that I do at Hanford, I work in the field of communications. Some people might call it public relations. But specifically, my task or specialty is public involvement. That is, as was mentioned in the announcements for ACE, Hanford is the biggest cleanup project in this country. By comparison, I don't think there's any place bigger in the Western Hemisphere. Russia's got some pretty ugly, nasty places too, but some of them we don't necessarily all understand yet. Hanford was part of the Manhattan Project, basically a top-secret place that confiscated 560 square miles in southeastern Washington about 1942, winter of 1942. The purpose was to take basically a pilot test that proved sufficient to create a nuclear reaction in a Chicago University lab under basically the stadiums of the football field underground there. And they took that, and within 18 months, they hired about, after they confiscated and moved some farmers off of the Columbia River and off the land, and decided that was the best place because Columbia River had cold water, and they needed cold water to cool nuclear reactors. Within 18 months, they had 50,000 people mobilized, and they were working three shifts a day, 7 days a week, and produced and basically turned on the first nuclear power plant, nuclear reactor to produce plutonium to generate the explosive material, if you will, for nuclear weapons. The nuclear material that was used in Nagasaki in Japan came from the Hanford site. What I'd like to be able to do is share with you some information about Hanford. I've got about a 7.5-8 minute video that talks a little bit about what the site is and where it's at today. I'd like to get into some discussion, make sure we share some information about what we've heard. Perhaps I can respond to some of the questions. I'm not a technical person. They call me a soft science person because I deal with communications and I deal with people. And if you ask me, I think people are a lot more interesting and more complicated sometimes than the technical do's and don'ts of, say, the scientific or engineering field. My job in terms of public involvement, again, is to bring the public to the decision makers and make sure that the public has heard something that's been new to Hanford and gradually evolving over the last 10 years after 40 years of secrecy. A few facts about Hanford. Over 60% of the nation's radioactive waste is stored at Hanford. That was produced primarily during World War II and the Cold War. The project that I'm working on is probably the most deadly of the waste that exists at Hanford. It's contained in 177 50,000 to 1 million gallon tanks. There's 177 of them ranging in size. Of that waste, it's the highest level, most radioactive waste that exists. And it's also laced or mixed with hazardous chemicals, acids, other hazardous chemicals that were used in processing the plutonium when they were producing it. At one point in time, they had 9 nuclear reactors fired up working full-time along the Columbia River. They said that this was in the 50s and 60s. There aren't any nuclear reactors that are in production to produce plutonium at this time. There is a, which often is sometimes confused, a nuclear cogeneration or a electricity-producing reactor just outside of Richland, where I live. They said at one time when all the reactors were running and they were dumping the cooling water out of the facilities, that they had actually increased the temperature of the Columbia River by over 1 to 2 degrees. When you think of the volume of the Columbia River and the size, it's amazing. They have found radioactive elements. I don't know for sure if it was before they put the dams in. I'm assuming it is. There's about 6 or 7 dams now along the Columbia River and the Snake rivers that runs in the Tri-Cities. If you know the Tri-Cities, there's Richland, Kennewick, and Pasco. They all sit on the confluence of 3 rivers, the Columbia, the Yakima, and the Snake, coming out of the east, northeast. Contaminants of radioactivity have been found on the west coast of the state of Washington and outside of the mouth of the Columbia. The contaminants had, to some degree, floated that far downstream, actually along the coast of Washington. The thing that's ominous about these 177 tanks is that there's 53 million gallons of the high-level waste stored in them. It'll be drawn out a little bit more in this video that I'm about ready to share with you. Hanford is probably one of the biggest sites, 560 square miles. Savannah River is quite large in South Carolina and in Idaho. In the eastern part of central Idaho, there is a large Department of Energy site as well. But they don't have the same level of radioactivity there. A lot of Hanford, of the 560 square miles, is basically a buffer zone around the outer ring of it. And the central part is where the radioactivity is stored in the tanks. And along the river, then, there are still these hulking masses of radioactive but shut down nuclear treatment plants. So that's a little bit of the background about it. Hanford is the only treatment facility, is the only site with high-level waste that does not have a treatment facility. Savannah River does in South Carolina. Idaho has basically taken their high-level waste and dehydrated it, if you will, and turned it into a powder. So it's in a less mobile condition. It's stored in canisters. Hanford's is liquid and sludge and crust in these aging underground tanks. Of the 177 tanks, 77 have known to have leaked. 76 to 77 are known to or have been confirmed to have leaked at least 1 million gallons into the soils under the site. The scientists of the time, 20, 30, 40 years ago, when they kept postponing the idea of treating the waste and finding a more better solution, the tanks were designed basically to be a 20 or 30 year temporary hold. They're going on 50, 55 years now. Like I mentioned, many of them have leaked. And a lot of them basically describe that there's 2 kinds of tanks, those that have leaked and those that will leak. During the Hanford production time, the technology of the time was, again, to cool it, the cooling water in open dirt trenches along the river and then drain them into the Columbia River, or at treatment facilities higher up into the central part of the site where the tanks are, is that they would literally discharge the liquids into the ground. They had estimated over 1 billion gallons of contaminated water had been dumped into the soil. The thought was is that it would take at least another 50 years. This is about 5 or 10 years ago when I started there. It would take at least another 25 to 50 years before the radioactivity would settle or filter through the soils in the plateau, the central part, under the tanks where they have leaked to this point, about 1 million gallons, before it would hit the groundwater about 200 feet below. In 1997, in November, the Department of Energy that operates the Hanford site confirmed that radioactive contaminants from the tanks, they could trace it by the type of radioactivity, had already reached the groundwater, which flows toward the Columbia River. The estimates are that it might take 25, 50 to 100 years before that radioactivity seeps into the Columbia River. Stakeholders who've been saying for the last 10, 20 years that radioactivity was going to get to the groundwater sooner than later are saying, you told us it was going to take 100 years to get to the groundwater, now you're saying it's going to take 100 years to get to the river. For some reason, they don't trust the estimates anymore. So, unless there's some specific questions or expectations that you might have, I'd like to run this video, give you some background, and open it up for some discussion.
How does the public deal with their anger on something like that?
Well, I find myself in the position often of facilitating that situation. There are people who are extremely angry. The thing that probably is frustrating to the, what I would call the environmental, or the, as they call themselves, the Hanford junkies, those that follow it very closely. The frustrating part is that people are so busy. The majority of the people, I think, in the state of Washington and Oregon, who has a big stake because the river is on their northern border, it's difficult to get people informed about this. That's one reason why I offered to lead this session while I'm up here on vacation, to be able to give people an opportunity to get some information about Hanford. There's just, it's difficult to get it out there. It gets lost sometimes in the hubbub of people's lives. Generally, when we go out to public meetings, we've seen the same people over and over and over again.
Is there anything positive that you can say about the Hanford site?
Is there anything positive I can say?
Like cleanup?
There is progress being made. A lot of people would say it's not fast enough. Some people would say it's not efficient enough. The state regulatory agencies of this state would say that there's not enough of a commitment to it. But there is progress being made. There was the Wyden watch list tank. Senator Wyden out of the state of Oregon basically identified a number of tanks, about 40 or 50 tanks, that had explosive capabilities. They were concerned that the gas is generating out of this witch's brew of chemicals and radioactivity that was contained in the tanks, even though there was air monitors. There was the infamous burping tank, where hydrogen gas would be building up under the crust and layers of the sediment, and a large volume would basically erupt or burp. And the fear was that if there was an activity going on remotely, that if a spark hit that flammable gas when it was released, that it could cause an explosion. The other concern was that if it built up to a level that was such where it blew the air filters and the systems that you'll see in these videos, there's probes that are in the tanks monitoring at the levels and so forth to some degree, that something like that would be blown out, there would be a release of airborne contamination. So most of those tanks have been cleared and have been, safety issues have been resolved. They put in safety measures and or identified ways to resolve those things. For example, in the burping tank, they basically put a 300 horsepower giant mixer pump in the tank to stir the waste up to be able to allow the natural release of the bubbles so that it wasn't building up and creating these large burping incidents. By end of September, all those tanks will be taken off, officially off the safety list. There are no longer, in the last 10 years, they've shut off and have tied off almost all, if not at least the obvious, drainage into the soil, so that is no longer happening. They have taken, I believe, 2 of the 9 reactors and have cocooned them. It's basically taking down all of the ancillary facilities around them, getting it down to the basic core, which is still extremely radioactive, and building a monolithic concrete wall or shelter around them to protect them from either critters getting into it or minimizing the cost of just maintaining these things. They're basically at the Hanford site. The budget right now is about $1.5 billion a year. Probably close to half of that is just to babysit the facilities that are still there deteriorating and need to be kept in some sort of safe, monitored form. Clearly, the best advantage is to continue to clean them up, minimize them, break them down, so that you reduce the mortgage, if you will, of annual maintenance, basically finding a permanent solution for the waste. The project that I'm on is basically the high-level waste tanks, and that's probably the most area that I know. That is the greatest danger on the site, that our stakeholders tell us, and our state to the governor calls it an underground Chernobyl waiting to happen. It's probably the most famous quote that he had a couple of years ago with Attorney General Christine Gregoire. But there are several things that have been happening. That in terms of cleaning up areas, There's a landfill the size of, it's huge. I can't remember how many. It has the option to be several square miles large. They're basically taking all the contaminated soils that they can dig up along the river and hauling it into the Central Plateau and dumping it into this giant leachate-lined landfill to minimize the contamination from runoff from either the river or streams, springs that flow into the river so it's not catching those contaminants.
Peter?
Yes?
You mentioned that the Department of Energy is operating it now. Has the Department of Defense, the Department of Energy always owned Hanford, or were there any private contractors like the Butler Flats or any of these other facilities?
Well,
and if so, what's their responsibility?
Okay, good question. Hanford was originally under the Atomic Energy Commission back in the 40s and 50s. Department of Energy is kind of the evolution of what was the Atomic Energy Commission. Several major contractors have been there. When I was doing my thesis out there, that's how I got a job out there. I was hired to do a study on the corporate culture of the Hanford site. At the time, Westinghouse was there, a major corporation who was in environmental cleanup or environmental work. Actually, they were there to do production of plutonium material, and the mission went away. The Cold War was ending, and they basically shut it down. They caught themselves trying to figure out how to clean up the messes that they'd been a part of generating in terms of the waste that was coming out of these facilities. So major contractors have been hired. It's always been owned by the federal government. The contractor that was in charge to build the site in the very beginning was DuPont. You had GE there. Westinghouse was there. There's been over 30 different contractors over 50 years that have been there, some of the major ones, some smaller ones. Right now, the major ones that are in place are CH2M Hill, that's their name, it's not an acronym. Bechtel National and Bechtel Hanford companies are there doing different elements of the cleanup project. Fluor Daniel is one of the major contractors there. There's quite a few major contractors. I am a contractor. I work for them. I don't work for the Department of Energy. The Department of Energy, if you've heard much about it, Los Alamos and the secret, what problems that they've had down there, secrecy, the spying, issues about, you know, sites burning up and that kind of thing last year, got a lot of negative press. Probably the studies have shown over looking at 600 different focus groups across the country several years ago, the federal government agency with the least respect and credibility is the Department of Energy. The only group or organization that has less credibility is the scum-sucking contractors like myself that work for them, assuming that we are on the dole, government dole, to do the government's dirty work, and we just continue to plug along at a slow pace and milk the taxpayers for all the money we can get as contractors and not getting much done. So that's kind of, I work at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. It's run by Battelle out of Columbus, Ohio, and there's a lot of science and research and laboratories there, and I just happen to be a communications person that works for them that's been matrixed to work with the Department of Energy to work on this particular tank project. So.
But what is the corporate responsibility? If Westinghouse was making plutonium-grade weapons material before the end of the Cold War, they were profiting then, and then they profit through the cleanup instead of taking responsibility for the cleanup. And I guess that's the question I have is, okay, to what degree are any of the...
Can you go back to them? Like with the Superfund site, Environmental Protection Agency would say, okay, this industry, copper mine, Superfund site right out here with all these tailings, Environmental Protection Agency tries to go back and find the cause of the damage to the environment. And if possible, to track them down, they will try to make them financially responsible. Well, because it was a federal site, it is a federal site, Hanford is a federal site, because it was doing basically producing material for defense and military purposes, there was a waiver in their contract basically says you are not financially responsible for the work you're doing. You're doing the bidding of the government. Basically, we don't have the expertise. We're hiring you to do the job. And so the government is ultimately responsible for it. And the question, one of the issues are, that I'd like to throw out to you, I'll just throw it out there now, and we can talk about this after I run this video, is Department of Energy continues, like I said before, to shortchange. I guess there's nothing sexy about cleanup. It's more interesting to build new and interesting weapon systems and put a lot of money toward that. And the cleanup of the most hazardous materials continues to be put off. Granted, up till recently, there hasn't been much technology or the scale to be able to clean this stuff up. Estimates right now to build a treatment facility to treat the Hanford tank waste, high-level waste, would be 2 to 3 times bigger than anything that exists in the world. You're talking about 30 metric tons of treatment per day of radioactive waste, turning it into glass, a glass material that would be stored in stainless steel canisters. We're talking about producing about 9,000 canisters of waste over 40 years' time. It'll take that long to treat this legacy from the war, from the Cold War. So we're talking a lot of stuff. Technology is such as it is. People say, well, let's just wait for that next round of technology. Let's wait for that next round of technology and see if we can do it cheaper. It's estimated to be about $30 to $40 billion over that 30 to 40 years to treat Hanford alone.
And this is Department of Energy budget, not Department of Defense budget.
Correct. They're closely tied, but it's primarily Department of Energy. Department of Energy is taking, in the current 2002 President's budget that was submitted, a hit of about $1 billion. Hanford, as it's trying to construct these facilities, it just hired contractors with incentivized contracts, which basically tells the contractors you don't get paid until you produce a product, the glass, the treated waste. The government looks like it's going to shortchange those contracts that are very financially supported, specific in terms of you get this much a year to build a facility, no more, no less. You don't get profit until you produce a facility that runs and works. The government's budget right now will not fund those contracts, and they will, looks like they'll go into default, and they'll have to renegotiate contracts that will put it back. 5 to 10 years is the estimate right now. So the question is whose responsibility is it? The government owns it, but the government says there are other priorities. Whether it's education or whatever, you know, people want to do tax reform. Everybody wants $200 to be able to buy a new muffler, so we want to make sure that everybody has that.
It's a missile defense. It's Star Wars.
And then there's a Star Wars plan that's out there that is increasing while the cleanup fund for this country is going down for the radioactive legacy that's been left behind from previous systems, war-making systems, war machines. Yes, ma'am?
Are there any lawsuits in place along the Columbia, the land and the people?
There have been some lawsuits in the past. Currently, in the state of Washington, the governor, the attorney general, and the Washington State Department of Ecology, which is the regulatory agency responsible, is poised to sue and or take legal action under what's publicly known as the Tri-Party Agreement. It's basically an agreement between the Department of Energy, Environmental Protection Agency, and the Washington State Department of Ecology. If there isn't adequate funding in the budget, which it looks like is real bleak, and it won't be confirmed by Congress until this September, at the end of this fiscal year, the state of Washington has strongly hinted that it's going to sue. The question is, if they sue, cleanup money goes toward lawsuits and courtrooms as opposed to actual cleanup dollars. Even if it's not enough to maybe build a treatment plant, they could be doing something at the site with some cleanup dollars. And so it's been a poker game for a number of years about do we sue, do we threat, do we actually do it. I believe the state's actually going to do it probably end of July or early August, and we'll see what happens.
But these suits are all based on failure to clean up, right?
But basically, correct.
Really, no suits can be brought in relation to the creation of the waste in the beginning, right? Because they were protected, the law, the government was protected from lawsuits, right?
Basically, that's true. Until about 10 or 15 years ago, nobody really knew what was at Hanford. The information has been flowing. There was a cloak of secrecy for over 40 years. We didn't know what there was. What they discovered when those curtains were pulled back a little bit was that you had an enormous, environmentally non-compliant place. completely out of compliance, and all the Superfund federal laws were brought to bear, and state laws were said, okay, you need to get there. Because of the lack of technology and or understanding and or because of the size, there was no way for DOE, even if they had all the money in the world, to be able to say, okay, we'll get it ready next week, we'll clean it up next year. It's a 30 to 40 year mission with the best of funding scenarios.
Well, what level of lobbying is going on in Washington? Is it any? Who's doing it? There is.
Well, the state is doing some. I will say that I have never seen, in 10 years that I've been around, I haven't seen a stronger coalition between particularly Washington and Oregon's congressional members. Even Idaho is getting on board. There is a strong effort, lobbying effort afoot that I am aware of that basically is trying to unify against this current administration all of the Department of Energy complex nationwide. There's about 7 or 8 other major sites, some with more political clout than Washington, Oregon, which is primarily Democratic, didn't vote for the current administration. You have a large facility down in Tennessee, did happen to vote for this administration, does happen to have a Republican congressman or two down that way. GW is going to pick which state is he going to try to befriend. It's probably going to either be the one that helped his administration or that he thinks will help him for re-election next time. So politically, we have very limited regional muscle, if you will. We don't have any real senior level people. The switch in the Senate recently to more of a Democratic mode, even though it's really tight, helped a little bit. Helped a little bit for this region. The scary part or element of it all, they had so much more fun. They were laughing in the previous section. They were having a good time in the previous class. Sorry if this is so doom and gloom, but it is, I think, very serious. As a native from the state of Washington, I have a lot of angst about what exists in our backyard and that something needs to be done about it. We can joke and we can laugh about it. I'm trying to find make light of it at times, but really there is a situation out here that basically is a national issue. We're talking something that's going to cost require a national commitment. There's people all over the country, in some cases from other parts of the world here, and I think that there are steps that we need to take if we are going to be able to influence what decisions happen, whether you want cleanup or you want a priority on something else. You need to let people know. I think Congress does listen if there's pressure coming from people. If there are letters and notes to Congress, they're the ones that basically can control the purse strings of this country and will determine what gets funded and what doesn't get funded.
Ken, Maria Campbell's on the Senate Energy Committee, is that correct?
I don't know if she's... I haven't gotten down all of the new committees that she's been recently appointed to, as I'm getting elected this fall. It took her a long time to get settled on the committees, especially with the changes. There's a major flux going on between the Senate side.
Sure.
On the Budget Committee is Doc Hastings. He's in the district where Hanford sits. So that is in the very, very early stages. They don't necessarily say that Department of Energy gets X amount of dollars, but they kind of set the policy level. And so he has been a very strong advocate. He is a Republican. There's a lot of people with a lot of jobs in his district that are affected. And so he's been lobbying hard, if you will, on the administration and trying to, at the same time, make the administration look good, at the same time trying to get funding in there to fund Hanford. But there are a lot of other sites around this country. I mean, how do you find, again, I guess that was kind of my point, I mean, now to finish before, is that there is an attempt to basically coalesce all of the environmental management, those that do cleanup sites in this country, and work together and saying overall, not just send all this, basically we need, we're about $400 million short at Hanford to have the funding to build a treatment plant. Don't send it all to Hanford, send it all. There's about a $1 billion short across the whole environmental management complex, treatment complex. Need to raise the funding for that project overall, so everybody gets what they want, so people aren't pointing fingers at one another and saying, Savannah River got more than me, and that's not fair because we at Oak Ridge deserve better than that in Tennessee, and there's this place called Pantex down in Texas that has been having problems, and not only have this Hanford, that big money pit up there, they keep working and working and never doing anything. Well, we probably got the biggest site. We've got the most challenging waste. And ideally, they would have built these tanks out of stainless steel. They were made out of carbon steel because during the war, there wasn't enough stainless steel to go around. And so you've got a tank that's double-walled with... the newest tanks are double-walled. They have two shells of steel. And then they're encased in concrete, about a foot thick of concrete. The older ones, 149 of the 177, are single wall, single shell, and those are the only ones that have leaked so far. Anyway, I'm going to run this video, and I'm talking way too much. I'd like for you to see that and see what you think, and we can open up for questions. It's about 8 minutes.
And who produced the video? Lenskamp.
This was produced by the Department of Energy, and so I'd like your opinion if you think it's a little too biased. Or not objective enough.
Shape.
Can you get the one in the corner? Thank you. Pardon me? Yeah, there should be sound wave by now. I'm very beginning of
my monitor. Zoom to 1 million.
Can you rewind a little bit?
Together, they might work.
There's a lot of animation. The ground, the tanks are underground. A lot of people think they're like fuel tanks or giant, you know, gasoline tanks that you see that would be above ground. Because of the radiation, they have to bury about 8 feet below the ground to create a natural barrier so that people working above and monitoring from above don't get a high dose of radiation.
Within a few miles of the Columbia River in southeast Washington, one of the nation's largest cleanup projects is underway at the Hanford site. 60% of the country's nuclear waste is stored here, 7 miles from the river, in 177 underground tanks. The waste is the result of decades of nuclear materials production for national defense. The tanks range in size from 50,000 to 1 million gallons. Together, they hold approximately 53 million gallons of radioactive and chemical waste in the form of sludge, salts, and liquid. It's enough waste to fill an area the size of a football field to a height of about 150 feet. 149 of the tanks consist of a single carbon steel shell surrounded by reinforced concrete. Expected to last 20 years, many are now about 50 years old. In the last 3 decades, 28 newer, safer double shell tanks have been built. These consist of 2 carbon steel shells surrounded by reinforced concrete. Although no tanks are currently known to be leaking, in the past, nearly a third of the single-shell tanks have leaked an estimated 1 million gallons of waste into the soil. There are concerns additional tanks could leak, and contamination could eventually reach the Columbia River. The Department of Energy's Office of River Protection will remove, treat, store, and dispose of the waste. The radioactive material from the tanks will be turned into glass, a process called vitrification. The Office of River Protection already performs waste removal operations at Hanford on a day-to-day basis. To reduce the risk of a future tank leak, all of the pumpable liquid is being moved from the older single-shell tanks to double-shell tanks. To solve a potential problem created by gas building up in double-shell tank SY-101, over 500,000 gallons of waste was removed. The waste level in this tank had been rising for years due to an increase of flammable hydrogen gas. Operators pumped out and diluted the waste, thereby avoiding a potential crisis.
We've made good progress over the last 7 years, stabilizing the tank farms, reducing near-term risk. Now it's time to move on to the long-term solution for Hanford tank waste. We're preparing to retrieve the waste from the tanks, turn it to glass, and put it away for long-term disposition. That's the ultimate solution to the Hanford tank waste problem.
A 350,000 square foot plant is being designed to turn Hanford's tank waste into glass. The vitrification process has been used on large-scale projects around the world and is a safe, proven technology. Before waste treatment at Hanford can begin, the Office of River Protection will make extensive improvements to the tank storage area to safely move the waste to the vitrification plant. Over time, much of the waste in the tanks has settled into layers. To remove this waste, large mixer pumps will be installed. The 300 horsepower pumps are over five stories tall in order to reach the bottom of the tanks and mix the waste so it can be removed. Transfer pumps will be installed to move the waste out of the tanks. A new network of pipes is also being installed to transport the waste to the vitrification facility for treatment.
It's ecologies and the state's number one issue at Hanford. It's our number one priority to get the retrieval and treatment of the tank waste started. And we can't start that without getting a treatment plant on the ground and going.
On a site next to the tank storage area, a construction force of more than 2,000 workers will build the vitrification plant. Construction of the plant will begin with the largest facility on the site. The pre-treatment building is big enough to cover three football fields. This facility will separate the waste into high-level and low-activity waste streams. Two vitrification facilities, one for each waste stream, will be built to mix the waste with molten glass. Site administration and support facilities will complete the vitrification facility complex. When the tank and waste transfer upgrades are complete and the vitrification facility is built, cleanup can begin. Mixer pumps inside the tanks will blend the waste that has settled into layers. Solids in the tank will be mixed with the liquids and the salts will be dissolved. The waste may also be diluted or heated to avoid plugging the transfer lines. Tank waste is then sampled to make sure it meets the requirements of the vitrification process. Finally, the waste is pumped out of the tank and routed through diversion stations to a main feed line leading to the treatment plant. Inside the pre-treatment building, the waste accumulates in holding tanks. From here, batches of waste will go through a series of steps designed to concentrate and separate it into high-level and low-activity waste streams. This will minimize the amount of highly radioactive waste, which is more expensive to dispose of. In the low-activity waste building, glass-forming materials are mixed with the waste. The mixture is then heated in a melter to about 2100 degrees Fahrenheit. Three melters in the low-activity building are capable of producing about 30 metric tons of glass per day. The molten glass will be poured into large stainless steel containers. The containers will be moved to a cool-down area and sealed. The process for turning high-level waste into glass is similar, but only one melter is needed because there is much less waste to treat. This smaller melter will be capable of producing about 1.5 metric tons of glass per day. The most critical component of this operation is the melter, which is based on technology in service at other facilities in the United States and Europe. A pilot melter testing a proposed Hanford design has performed at a superior level, producing glass at over 150% of its expected production rate. After the sealed high-level canisters are decontaminated and prepared for storage, they will be moved to Hanford's existing canister storage building. The canisters will remain here until a permanent national disposal site is established. The Office of River Protection will dispose of the low-activity waste containers on the Hanford site in underground concrete trenches. During the first phase of cleanup, the Office of River Protection is scheduled to vitrify a minimum of 10% of the waste by volume, or about 25% when measured by radioactivity. That's the equivalent of about 600 canisters of high-level waste glass and about 8,500 containers of low-activity waste glass. However, based on the vitrification plant's expected operating efficiency, the treatment percentages are expected to be higher.
If we were to do nothing and not retrieve and treat the tank waste, within 20 years you would start to see impacts in the groundwater right beneath the tanks, from the failing tanks and from the waste leaking from the tanks.
40 years of plutonium production in the National Defense created the Hanford tank waste problem, the largest environmental cleanup challenge in the country, and it will take significant time and funding to solve this problem. We can't afford to delay this cleanup. We must make cleanup of the Hanford tank waste a national priority to protect the Columbia River, the surrounding communities, and the economy of the Northwest. Let's all work together to make this project a success.
One thing I want to clarify, it said is there were pre-treating and dividing the waste in two forms. They're very misleading in some cases how they've labeled it. It's called high-level and low-activity waste. The high-level is the highest high-level fraction that they would divide it up. The low-activity waste is still extremely highly radioactive waste. It's just that it doesn't meet the criteria to be sent to a national repository. That's only going to be about 3 to 5% of the actual volume of waste that we would treat at Hanford. But it's still, the high-level waste probably has a half-life of about 10,000 years. The low-activity waste is only about 2 or 3. So, still extremely hot.
2 or 3,000 years.
Sorry for, yeah. 2 or 3,000 years. The gentleman you saw talking at the very end, he's basically the second manager for the Office of River Protection. Congress created the Office of River Protection. It's basically an act by Congressman Hastings to focus the most contaminated area at the Hanford site out from under the traditional bureaucracy of the Department of Energy. The group that I'm working with basically is... at headquarters in Washington, D.C., we're considered to be a rogue site or field office because we don't play necessarily by their bureaucracy. We try to have one point of contact, Harry Boston, who you saw in the video. He is the one that is ultimately tells people and assumes responsibility for what happens or what doesn't happen. The rest of the site is managed by another field office. As DOE calls them, and responsible for a large, basically three-fourths of the rest of the Hanford site. Again, the highest radioactivity is right there in the tanks itself. Any questions or follow-ups from that video? Or I'd like to know your impression of it. Was it any good? DOE did produce it.
Well, I mean...
I didn't bring the one from Oregon that I have.
I guess the question I have always is, what can you believe? I mean, back in 1980... I was part of the anti-nuclear movement. We had evidence of plutonium contamination at Rocky Flats.
Right.
And we would talk about that all the time, and all the time the government denied it, and the contractors denied it, etc. And these are the same people now who are charged with cleaning it up. They first of all said it didn't exist, and they kept that up for at least 10 years.
Right.
And then now they're saying, well, we can solve this, and it's only going to take... this number of years, et cetera. And I guess part of my reaction is that where are all these people who voted for all these weapons in the first place? There were a number of people who opposed them, and why should we be paying for the cleanup if we didn't want them in the first place? I mean, that's the biggest question I have, is why is the money not coming out of the Defense Department budget instead of the Department of Energy?
There is some real logic to what you're saying. Why not close the loop that you created? You started a loop, you created a mess. I mean, I was taught by my parents and my teachers, you make a mess in your room, you got to clean it up. Hanford is a big sandbox that our government, the United States government, was responsible for messing up. And somebody needs to clean it up. I mean, that's what the state of Washington is telling us. That's what a lot of people are saying. And frankly, I think there's an obligation to close that loop.
I was just wondering, are there any deaths from cancers that can be traced to the Hanford site?
Yes, and I would say that variety of illnesses. I mean, it's hard to say what's primary or secondary and what the causes were to workers, particularly over the first, say, 20, 30, 40 years. A lot of people took doses of radioactivity. Some of them didn't even know what they were doing and what the hazards that we were facing. And the Congress recently passed a law or an act that basically says that the federal government will compensate those victims. And I think recently Congress, after an outcry from the public, if your family members are now deceased, that are survivors, family members, survivors, will also be entitled to some form of compensation if they can prove and verify illnesses that were more closely associated with Hanford.
I was thinking of people living around the area.
There have been several studies of downwind contamination that might have happened in, from Spokane to Idaho to into Idaho and southwestern Washington. From what I know of those studies, they haven't been able to conclusively say that Hanford itself and what they call the green runs of the 40s and 50s, where they intentionally emitted what they called green emissions or unfiltered emissions into the atmosphere to see what would happen, to see how they would carry, see if, as they measured downwind, the effects of how it traveled and what kind of radioactivity you picked up on, say, ground samples and so forth, then they could measure what the Russians were doing and check atmospheric conditions and see what they were doing, because then they could compare it to their test with our test. Those things haven't been coming out until the last half a dozen years in terms of something that our government was doing. The fact that they were doing experiments on prisoners in prison in the 40s and 50s and 60s, sometimes to their knowledge and sometimes not, to find out what radioactivity would do to the human body. So they could set standards to help people who are working in the field know how to take care of it, or how, what limits they could be exposed to without necessarily having obvious effects. So it's a roundabout way to answer your question, but it's fairly complicated. Nuclear power, radioactivity is a fairly new science, I think, for a lot of people in about 50 years. And when you think about some of the histories and things that they've had to do to understand other illnesses and other diseases and other causes for symptoms, it's on a new early stage of development in terms of understanding it. But clearly, it's one of the most deadly elements known to the human race.
Is fusion ever possible?
I warned you, I wasn't a technical person. There continues to be research done on a fusion-type energy source. There's been spending billions and billions of dollars on looking at that kind of technology to see if that's an option. There's a lot of energy, no pun intended, a lot of interest in regenerating nuclear energy and in the terms of the nuclear. You've all read these things perhaps in the paper and seen them, heard them on the news, in terms of reasserting ourselves in terms of the nuclear energy world, given the energy crises in other places, and the administration's on record saying this is a clean energy source and a safe energy source that we should be considering. It's one thing in the video that I don't necessarily care for, and it talks about the safe, proven technology turning the stuff to glass. When you're dealing with deadly materials, there's always a risk of some kind. There's always a chance, and that's a little too PR-ish for me. But yes.
I noticed that the video mentioned that after the waste is vitrified, it would be stored in these canisters on the site until a national repository is located.
Good point.
And I know that our friends down in Nevada aren't too thrilled to have the Yucca Mountain site converted to a nuclear waste repository, and no one wants it in their backyards.
Correct.
Seems like that would be a sign. First, we wouldn't want to produce more of it with more nuclear facilities. But I'm wondering how that plays out. I mean, right now, Nevada is a state. How does that impact?
Is everybody familiar with Yucca Mountain? It's a designated by Congress a federal repository to put all the high-level radioactive waste. Right now, the first priority are the nuclear the private or commercial nuclear reactors that are having their storage facilities filled up, having their waste, radioactive waste, transferred into this national repository and have it stored there underground in these big basalt caverns that they would be digging out. It was supposed to open several years ago. They still are doing the testings. They haven't gotten the permits from the state of Nevada. For some reason, Nevada is being extra cautious around the permitting process. Essentially, when the Senate was shifted to the Democratic Party, Senator Daschle of South Dakota and the senator from Nevada basically said, Yucca Mountain National Repository in Nevada is dead. It will not open. We will not have the waste shipped into our backyard. We won't have these radioactive logs, glass logs, or what have you, canisters traveling across our highways and through our towns. The stakeholders that I hear from the state of Washington and Oregon basically have advised the Department of Energy for a number of years now, don't plan on Yucca Mountain ever to open. Don't add an element of risk of shipping it another place and creating another potential hazard for somebody else. Find a safe way, safe as you can, to market, place it in the middle of the Hanford site someplace where it's going to hopefully be safe for 10,000 plus years. So there's a lot of uncertainty about what's going on. The fact that we do have to, under federal law, pre-treat, separate the waste into this low-activity waste and this high-level waste means we're building a third, basically, treatment facility, the pre-treatment facility, the first one they talked about in the video. That's about $1 billion in and of itself to build that one treatment plant. We aren't getting enough funding because we have to make the assumption that we have to build a pre-treatment plant, we have to pre-treat the waste, divide it and split it out, and then treat it in a separate way. So it costs a project that needs to happen more money because we need to make these assumptions that this is still going to happen when everybody's saying it's not going to happen. So nobody's willing to bet their mortgage on Yucca Mountain ever opening.
So the only reason why it would be separated is because some of it may go somewhere else, but otherwise there's really no logical reason for that? Or would it be, is it eventually stored in a different way? Or
At Hanford, the plan is to store it in the same way. They would be stored in, they would be converted into glass, the liquid glass would be poured into stainless steel canisters, allowed to cool, and then sealed. The high-level waste, the rate waste that would have the highest or longest half-life of radioactivity was the nasty stuff. They're going to ship it to a national place, so it's in one place. The stuff that's, again, not quite as nasty would be in the same forms and stored, would not be shipped off of Hanford, which is, as you can tell by my beautiful scale map here, if you don't know where Hanford is, it's basically in the southeast corner. About an hour from Walla Walla, about 2.5 hours from Spokane, Yakima would be right about here. It's about a nice three and a half hour drive to Fields Point from my house in Richland, Washington. Yes?
I don't want to open a can of worms. I just want to kind of...
That's okay.
Maybe a yes or no question or answer. Cleanup is related to supply. We have to continue to supply energy and we're going to build more of these things. And supply makes me think that it's related to demand. Is anybody in the Department of Energy or where you're connected ever talk about demand? And the can of worms is population growth and all that kind of thing. Does anybody talk about that?
Demand in the sense of...
A demand for more energy, for more...
Yes. I mean, there is a... strong contingent, if you will, that would still like to be able to get back into, say, the nuclear energy producing business. A lot of technical folks still think it's a viable option. Problem is we don't have a place to put the waste that's generated. I mean, it's not a closed loop by any means, assuming that even that would help you be at peace with with producing nuclear energy of some form. But yes, there is a strong effort afoot at a federal policy level of looking at bumping up. There hasn't been a nuclear reactor built in this country for, I think, about 20 years, or at least permitted for about at least 20 years. And the idea is right now that there might be an option to go forward and do that again to produce the energy. Grant, they are producing nuclear reactors in third world and Eastern Bloc countries. That's the most viable, quote unquote, viable for them sources of getting energy in some parts of the world. And they are, American companies are building them there, but public opinion has not allowed or has not even allowed them to venture applying for a permit for one in this country for a long time. Did that answer your question? Definitely wasn't a yes or no answer.
Sorry. I'm not sure I even understand my question. All this relates to population growth to me.
There is an energy problem.
Yeah.
And it's growing.
And as we grow in our standard of living and all that stuff, that's the can of worms, standard of living.
The people, I like coming to Holden because I tend to let my short hair down. And in my job, I tend to be one who is the facilitator and the one who's neutral. And I can come up here a little bit and be a little more biased in what I say and what I do. But I'll just put it this way. The environmentalists of this region basically have said you aren't doing enough to conserve energy. You aren't doing enough to look at other alternatives that don't seem, or at least as far as we can tell, have the same ratio of creating waste for the energy that you get for it. That there might be more efficient ways, whether it's solar or wind, other venues that might be worth investing a lot of money in, but still worth investing in, as opposed to going down a path that, at least at this point, still hasn't been able to be closed in terms of the waste cycle that's associated with producing energy. Yes?
Yes, I grew up surrounded by DOE scientists in Los Alamos. And,
okay.
I guess the thing that really concerns me looking into the future is that it really does seem that most of the scientists involved in this that I know, that I grew up with, including my dad, are really not thinking out of the box on this. I mean, really, really seem to think that nuclear is our only viable option for an expensive energy source for the future, and that this really does continue to be the way that we have to go. I mean, am I totally off on that kind of sense, or?
Well, I come from a very biased niche in the environmental business at Hanford, and the thing that, from a cultural perspective, looking at a major bureaucracy and an organization, it's there are major sites around this country, and each one thinks that they're unique and very, very special, and the other guys are, you know, boo-hoo. There's not much interchange going on, but there tends to be a lot of rotation around from one place to another from the same experts, scientists, engineers, and so forth. I think, by and large, yes, I would agree with you, that they think that this is the way to go, that this is proven, they can do this, they know more safety ideas now to make these plants more safe and build new nuclear facilities. And the money tends to be in making them and not cleaning them up.
Well, my secondary concern is just going to be the other can of worms. Are we going to start exporting our waste, which just seems to be, I mean, a huge problem for the rest of the world.
And to any particular place? I mean,
Russia wants
it. Yeah, Russia. Yeah.
Russia wants our waste?
Yeah.
Siberia.
Well, there's been some, I have heard some talk about that. I'm not sure how serious I've heard about that. Being, I've heard it the other way, that they should send their waste to us so we can process it and safely treat it someplace, at least store it here so that they can extrapolate the plutonium and or sell it off to some enterprising terrorist of some kind, thank you, that could go and produce their own bomb or some sort of weapon. So I've heard of coming here, not necessarily sending ours someplace else. The outcry, I think, from the environmental community would be such that it would never get to the dock to ship it someplace. Again, they are shipping wastes, maybe not as high level or radioactive as what's in Hanford right now. There are shipments of radioactivity being shipped. Fuel rods, for example, from England shipped to Japan to run their nuclear reactors down there. They process the fuel rods so that they're just right. They have the facilities in one part of the world, and they ship it to another place where they can run nuclear energy producing plants. So that is an issue. And I guess I just, maybe it's, I'm preaching to the choir here, or it's an obvious maybe sense, but I think it's important to understand where both sides are coming from so that you can come together and hopefully find some sort of way of resolving this. But to me, the question is it an obligation of the government to follow through with this, granted that, and I've done the calculations, I think it would be several hundred dollars at least per year per taxpayer to fund Hanford cleanup alone. Is that something on top of the taxes you may be paying already, something that we as a nation are obliged to do? And then what is the next step or action that we're responsible to follow through with, if that is what we're willing or think is the right thing to do?
One of the comments I was going to make was that I think I live in Texas, and yes, I would venture to say that, I don't know what percentage, maybe I'm being bad, but I would venture to say very few people know that Hanford exists outside of this area. Everybody knows Los Alamos, and perhaps that would be one of the big things. I think people would be very concerned, but I don't think it's known at all.
Yeah.
A lot of people in Texas don't know Pentex exists.
That's right.
And
growing up,
that's in their own state.
But I think it's just outside of this area. When you talk about the developing the bomb, everybody knows Los Alamos. Everybody knows that. I think you could go anywhere in the country and they know it. And I would venture to guess almost anywhere outside of this area, the percentage of people that know Hanford is very small.
That has been a major frustration for us in terms of trying to create a national priority to fund this thing and create an awareness of what we need to do. And it's difficult. I mean, next week, 60 Minutes is coming to interview my customer who was on here and some other people and stakeholders. I happened to provide them some names in terms of the producers so that they would talk to some third-party people from the state of Washington, from the state of Oregon, and environmental groups that have been tracking him for a number of years. And they probably had those names already, but made sure that they had them so they could get their perspective. But I mean, 60 Minutes is going to create some sensitivity of this. They're not into the news business. They're into the entertainment business. And what they're trying to do is basically say, from the questions that they've been leading with so far, is that it's been a big waste of money at Hanford, and you shouldn't give them any more money. I personally believe that they have been, at least the project that I'm biased about, has turned that around and has in place the technology for the first time. The only thing that's missing is the federal funding commitment to make it happen. And granted, it's a long time. It's going to be a long-term mission. The politicians are thinking 2 to 4 years at a time. They aren't thinking 20 to 40 years. And so there's probably... I just sometimes remember how naive I was 15 years ago about the political process, and sometimes I wish I didn't know what I know today about what it takes to get a project and keep a project going.
The video is puzzling in that if I hadn't heard your talk, I would have thought this is all under control, and I might have missed the fact that they said will 500 times. This will happen, this will happen, this will happen. It didn't talk about subject to funding, subject to how many years, subject to... Like, who's the video for? If anything, it seems to... I'm from the state of Washington and knew about Hanford.
Yes.
From a long time ago, I don't know how, through what grapevine, I think, they've got a plan.
This video was produced about a year ago.
Down rather than to create more public support, which... your information certainly suggests is urgently necessary.
That's why I think almost any video needs to be, the stage needs to be set for it, or any set of information needs to be put in context. This video was produced last fall, and before the funding cycle that we and the current administration that we have in place took power. I will say this, and worst thing they can do is fire me, I guess. But I have never seen an administration that has been so cloak and dagger in terms of what the impacts will be of the current budget proposed as the one that we have now. They have basically shut down my boss and threatened to fire him if he talked about the impacts publicly of the current budget proposal. We basically have had a gag order on our budget people and ourselves. We have Hanford is unusual because we go out and we do in the spring budget meetings around the region, talking about the budget, what we did last year with the money that we got, what we plan to do in the out years with the budget cycle that's being proposed by the administration for the coming fiscal year and the out years. We're 3 months behind in the budget cycle because of the transition and because they basically were withholding information. We have had to do some very cloak and dagger techniques to try to get information out to the public, to our congressional representatives, to our senators and such, so that they would understand before the tax bill and everything else was rammed through Congress that there was a clear understanding. And we've had riders put on the bill that would increase the funding. A supplemental is just, you know, the spin doctors are very busy these days in Washington, D.C. They always are. I don't care what the administration is, but they're working pretty hard right now. A supplemental budget was passed and sent to Congress last week, I think it was, of about $100 million for environmental management cleanup. We're $1 billion short. But they've been playing it really big that there's $100 million for all of the nation for environmental management. $55 million of that is going to Hanford. I think I mentioned before, we're at least $400 million short. So it sounds good. We're giving them more money. It's a top priority. But it's basically at a rate that will kill the projects that we have currently planned today. And will put us back into a babysitting maintenance mode at best. While tanks and facilities, transfer lines, et cetera, continue to deteriorate and leak. So we are out of time. I think chapel is coming up in a few minutes. So I really appreciate your patience. Thank you for your time.